FS Insider, a premium edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. Today's host is PFS Group President Jim Poplava.
Greetings, everyone, and welcome to a special edition of Financial Sense Insider. For the holiday weekend, we're featuring highlights from Jim Poplava's Investment Strategy Conference from October 21st of this year. The charts and visuals referred to on this program can be found with the program description on the website at financialsense.com.
Before we begin, I want to start on a personal note. You notice the change from PFS Group to Financial Sense. It's amazing. I started my career in radio 30 years ago this past summer. Not only did I start doing radio, but I also started doing my own advertising on radio and doing our own ads. The advertising agency at that time begged my wife to stop me. Basically, in the words of the agency, I suck. But fortunately, I took voice lessons and singing lessons, although I will not be singing today, so you can rest assured. And so it's been 30 years. The program is more from a weekend show to a daily show. And now the podcast. I just met somebody that's here from China that listens to the program. So Financial Sense has gone international. And the nice thing with technology, we can reach listeners all around the globe. The other thing I want to talk about is, even though we are growing and expanding, we still like to keep the personal touch. And as you know, when you call our office, you don't get an answering machine. You don't have to press a button to get a certain department. You get a friendly voice, which is Crystal. Crystal, are you here? Oh, she's outside. We got Crystal when she failed to make the cutoff on The Voice, and she decided to get into financial planning. No, just seriously. The other thing, too, is we were able to add Alan as our compliance officer with all the regulatory reforms and regulations going through Washington that affects our industry. It's nice to have somebody of his experience. But unfortunately, with Alan's presence here today, I will not be able to talk about our hedge fund that guarantees 20% returns each year, no risk, and is suitable for all investment ages. With that in mind, let's get started. When we put together our presentations each year, we try to think of a theme for the seminar, not only in terms of what is going on in the market and the economy, but what we think may unfold in the next year. This year, we're going to go a little bit deeper than that. We're going to look back at the last 30 and 40 years and bring you up to the present and why we are seeing so many unusual events. When I was putting together the presentation, I thought of the lines from Dickens' Two Tales of a City. It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. It was the age of wisdom. It was the age of foolishness. It was an epic of belief, incredulity, of light, darkness, hope, and despair. And we've seen just about everything over the last three or four decades. Now, some of the headlines, I began my career in investments in 1980. At that time, the Iranians had captured the U.S. embassy. There were a number of events that we saw on the geopolitical front over the last three or four decades. And there's a number of events that we've seen in the financial world, including the financial crises, and you'll see shortly numerous financial bankruptcies over the last three or four decades. A friend of mine was visiting me for my birthday 2 weeks ago from Israel, and we were talking about some of the events that we were seeing on the news and what we are seeing today that we haven't seen, if you think about it. When we used to watch the news, if it was a terrorist event, it was Jerusalem, it was Lebanon, it was something that happened in the Middle East. Today, we see it all over the globe, whether it is in Jerusalem, Tel Aviv, Paris, London, Brussels, New York, Boston, San Bernardino, and more recently, Vegas. We're also seeing financial events take place of crises, not just here, but also overseas. So it truly has been an extraordinary era. Now, this is a graph I'm going to be presenting to you several times throughout this seminar. I just want to, at this point, concentrate on a few key items. First is from the first three or four decades up until about 1970. There's one thing you will see that is absent on this left side. These gray bars represent recessions. This graph right here represents the federal funds rate. So when you hear that the Fed is raising interest rates, that is a graph of the short-term rates which determine borrowing. What happened after 1970 is the dollar got decoupled from gold. And from that point, the amount of debt began to grow in the economy. And you'll see how that plays in terms of what is happening in the markets and our economic growth. Another factor I want you to observe, this is a rise in the Fed funds rate leading to a recession. You can see there, there, there. Every recession since World War II has been preceded by a Fed rate raising cycle. Ryan mentioned, and if you listen to the show, we spent a lot of time talking about the Fed. Because when they raise interest rates, we have a saying on the show, they'll keep raising them until they break something, usually in the economy or in the markets. Thank God they don't run airlines because nobody would travel. But it's also important, not just from an economic point of view, but also from a market point of view. They say there's a saying that bull markets do not die of old age. The Federal Reserve has killed each and every one of them. So when the Fed embarks on a rate-raising cycle, we pay a lot of attention to it. There's been very few times that they have raised rates that have not led to a bear market or a recession. One of them was in the 80s, in 83. This is 87. They raised the Fed funds rate from 7 to 10% in a period of 4 months, which led to the stock market crash in 87 when the Dow lost 23% in a single session. Another period that they raised interest rates without a recession was in 94. Greenspan raised the Fed funds rate from 3 to 6%. It didn't lead to a recession nor a bear market, but it led to the bankruptcy of Orange County, which had bet in derivatives on the wrong direction. So we're going to spend some time on this because every recession and bear market has been preceded by a Fed rate raising cycle. This is where we are. I'll have more to say about that in just a minute. This summer, I read a book for the second time. It was called A History of Interest Rates. And classic books maintain their status because of the wisdom that they impart. When I was in the middle of reading this book for the second time, I had an epiphany. I began my career in the investment markets in 1980 and 1981. If you recall, at that time, interest rates were close to 20%. As my career has matured, we are now witness to the lowest interest rates in 5,000 years of human history. I had the privilege of interviewing the professor this last August, and when I revealed to him that thought, his comments were, anybody alive today is part of a special period of history where we've seen the extreme highs to the extreme lows. Now, it was written originally by Sidney Homer. If you don't know who Sidney Homer was, he was the senior partner at Salomon Brothers and turned Salomon Brothers into a powerhouse in the bond trading department. The book has been upgraded by Professor Silla. Now, what the revelation that really hit me was this graph right here. This is a graph of interest rates over 5,000 years. You can see that was interest rates under the King Hammurabi in 3000 BC, 20%. It would take 5,000 years to get back close to 20% again, and another 30, 40 years to get to the lowest point in history. For any of you doing fact-checking, I did not know Hammurabi personally, but what really struck me about this graph was not only where we have gone in 5,000 years, but throughout human history. Think about this for a moment. 5,000 years, the average interest rate was 6 to 8%. It remained that way for almost 5,000 years. Now, there were periods where short-term interest rates spiked. That's these blue lines here. And they were usually during periods of war, the Punic War, the Napoleonic Wars, the Revolutionary Wars. Interest rates would spike because what do governments do in wartime? They spend a lot of money and they debase their currency. But over time, interest averaged 6 to 8%. Today, we're in the range of close to 2%. Something else I want to emphasize here that will play a lot of what we see today. Before the existence of money, there was the existence of credit. In Hammurabi's time, there wasn't money. Money didn't come into play until about 700 BC with the king of Lydia, which started developing the coins and money the way we use it today. If you were in Babylonian times and you lived in the countryside and you were a farmer and needed to borrow, there wasn't any money. So you borrowed grain and it was measured at a rate of interest of 33%. If you were a merchant in the city, you borrowed at a rate of 20% in silver. So before money, there was credit. And we'll see much of what we know as money today really is in the form of credit, whether it's credit cards, a line of credit on your home, mortgages, securities, student loans. Credit is another form of money. We use credit more than we do money today. Now, this is the other side of that graph that I showed you, and I want you to pay attention because there are several key factors that are developing here. This is the federal funds rate, and these gray bars are recessions. The trend that you will notice is lower highs and lower lows. In every recession, which is preceded by a Fed rate hike, in the next business cycle, the Fed has been unable to raise interest rates before a recession took place. The last time the Fed raised rates, the Fed funds rate was only 5%. Greenspan brought it down to 1%. There's something called the Atlanta Shadow Fed, which takes into consideration not only interest rates, but the inflation rate. We actually got down to negative interest rates. So when you think about this Fed cycle, we are now at 1.25%, soon to go to 1.5% on the Fed funds rate. The Fed itself is predicting they will take this rate to 2.75%. We don't think they make it that far. It is more likely we will get to 1.75% to 2.25% before we head into our next recession, which we estimate to be towards the end of 2018 and 2019. It may be extended as a result of tax cuts. So I'll have more to say about that in the fourth hour. But the trend in place is clear. It is trending down. When you think about it, the Fed brought interest rates down to zero in the last financial crisis, where in previous cycles, the lows were 6%, 3%, 1% under Greenspan, and zero under Bernanke. The trend over the next couple of years, like it or not, is going to be interest rates, low interest rates are here to stay at least for the remainder of this decade. Even though they may rise slightly, rates are likely to remain low. You want to look at interest rates, another way to measure it is the height of Fed chairmen. The peak of interest rates, it was Paul Volcker, 6'7", Greenspan was 5'11", Bernanke 5'8", and Yellen was 5. In January next year, Yellen's term as the Fed chairman comes up for renewal. If the next Fed chairman is Michael Jordan, we're in trouble. Now, why has the rate of interest rates been going down? The reason, plain and simple, is credit. The folks at Bank Credit Analyst called it the debt supercycle. And every business cycle, as the Fed brought down interest rates, borrowing would increase in society. Government borrowing, state borrowing, corporate borrowing, and individual borrowing. Today, outstanding debt in the United States is over $54 trillion. We're adding a rate of debt of about $1 trillion each year. And one of the reasons the debt increased is, what were you able to do as interest rates came down? It became more affordable to take out debt. I remember when Mary and I first got married, our first home, we got a 9% mortgage and we were so grateful. Can you imagine a 9% mortgage today? Our next mortgage was 12%. And fortunately, when we moved to California, I read Gary Shilling's book, Deflation Ready or Not, and I went to a variable rate mortgage. And as we have seen over the years, the rate of interest has come down. But the main reason you've seen this increase in debt has been because interest rates have come down. Now, if you're the Federal Reserve, in the last financial crisis, they reduced interest rates to zero. What do you do when you bring interest rates down to zero? How can you stimulate the economy? Well, they did it through something called quantitative easing, another fancy word for money printing. And what the Fed did is they printed money out of thin air, and they went into the mortgage markets and the treasury markets, and they bought long-term bonds. What did that do? It brought down long-term interest rates. At its peak, the Fed was buying $80 billion a month in treasuries and mortgage bonds, and the central banks in Europe and Japan were doing the same thing. The ECB is buying $60 billion worth of bonds, which is one of the reasons they were able to turn around the crisis that occurred in Europe in 2011. What's interesting now is central banks are now starting to raise interest rates. The ECB is talking about taper. And as you know, beginning this month, the Fed is going to begin reducing its balance sheet, which currently stands at $4.5 trillion. They went from about $800 billion to $4.5 trillion in the crisis. And after several years, it began to impact the economy. By 2012, housing prices were rising again. Real estate was recovering. The balance sheet of our financial institutions were in better shape because the mortgages they had lent out, the asset underlying that mortgage, real estate, was starting to rise, and it took them out of a financial crisis. So basically, the Fed recapitalized banks in the process. Now, where has this led us to? Here, once again, is the federal funds rate. And as I mentioned, we live in an extraordinary time. If you look at interest rates, they are not only the lowest in history, but many of them are negative. $9 trillion of debt, sovereign debt, is negative. And if you can see there, if you bought a two-year note in Germany, you would pay the German government 0.7% a year. In Italy, a little over 1/10. In Switzerland, almost 1%. In Japan, 0.1%. Now, you might ask yourself, who in their right mind would lend money to government and then pay them interest? The reason is corporations and institutions. If you are Apple and you are sitting on $250 billion in cash, where do you park it? You can't put it in a bank, because you're only a guaranteed $250,000. So it's primarily institutions that are parking money. And one of the reasons long-term interest rates remain low in the U.S. is if you take a look, the two-year note in the U.S. is 1.36. If you went to Germany, you would pay the German government money. If you went to Italy, you would pay them money. If you went into Switzerland, you'd pay them money. So it is one of the things that we are seeing is large capital inflows into the dollar, into the United States. If you are Apple and are sitting on $250 billion in cash, where are you going to put it? You're going to put it in the local bank in SNL? First of all, they couldn't handle that kind of money. So institutional investors are putting their money in sovereign debt because it's one of the safest places you can keep money. Now, this is the yield curve. Now, what this is interest rates based on maturity. Here's the 10-year note. Why that's important, most of the mortgages that are taken out on real estate are based on the yield of the 10-year note. So as the 10-year note rises, so will your mortgage. This is where we were a year ago. This is where we are today. You can see the impact of Fed funds raising. We're up now about a little over 0.5%. Now, a lot of us in the industry has used this yield curve to predict recessions. What would happen before a recession? The Fed would keep raising interest rates. The long-term bond market would start to go down because what investors were doing is they could see a recession coming, so they would go into the long-term end of the market, driving it down. The Fed would be raising interest rates short-term. Short-term rates were higher than long-term rates. That is now distorted as a result of central bank intervention. So we really don't have true markets. Now, it has led to something else. It has led to something called financial repression. And that is the deliberate attempt by government to suppress interest rates and keep them down for two reasons. One, it's cheaper for governments to finance debt. Two, it's cheaper for you, the consumer or a corporation, to go out and borrow. And they do that through capping, requiring banks to hold large amounts of treasury, which came in with Dodd-Frank. As the Fed started paying interest rates on reserves, the Fed was recapitalizing what was essentially at that time a bankrupt financial system. How does this work? And how did we get to where we are? We got there because as a result, in every single economic cycle, we increase the amount of borrowing. You can see there over the years, and this is a key point right here. Notice right around the year 2000 how debt accelerated. It's now accelerating at the federal level. The reason interest rates, once again, were brought down to low levels. Greenspan, in the 2000 recession, 2001, he brought the Fed funds rate to 1%. He kept them there until 2004. Bernanke eventually brought it down to zero, and he kept it there 6 years. The phenomenal thing when you look at this, the Fed began to announce it was going to start raising interest rates. They did that in 2013 when they announced tapering. Basically, they said, we're going to cut back on the amount of money printing that we're going to do. Do you realize it's taken them 4 years to raise interest rates only five times? In 2004, when Greenspan began to raise rates, he raised interest rates a quarter of a point at every single Fed meeting until they put us in a recession in 2007. So what we've seen is in each recession, businesses added more debt because the cost of borrowing was coming down. The Fed would lower interest rates to stimulate the economy, but they never allowed the economy to cleanse itself. One of the things that low interest rates have done is it's kept a lot of what we call zombie companies out there alive, companies that have poor credits, poor business models, but they're able to refinance their debt now at lower rates, which still keeps them in business. Now, who's the big beneficiary of all this? The government. And here's a phenomenal fact. When Obama took office, the national debt was at $10 trillion. Over the course of his presidency, he added $9.6 trillion of debt. So we've had two presidents in the 21st century. George W. Bush doubled the national debt from $5 to $10 trillion, and Obama doubled it from $10 to $20 trillion. But here's the remarkable thing, and this is how financial repression works. In 2008, the U.S. government paid out $451 billion in interest. Fast forward 8 years, $9.6 trillion more debt. Notice what the U.S. government paid. $432 billion. In other words, we paid close to $20 billion less in interest, even though we added $9.6 trillion more in debt. The reason I'm pointing this out is the Trump presidency faces something the government has not seen in 8 years. For the first time, this amount of interest is now starting to rise after 8 years of falling. So the 2017 fiscal year, annual interest on the debt will exceed the previous high reached at 451 in 2008. And that has tremendous implications, not only for the Trump presidency, but also for the tax reform, which I'll talk about more later. So what has this all led to? What does it look like? The folks at PIMCO have called it the new normal. You can see there the increase in student loans up 170%, a tripling in food stamps, a quadrupling of debt, money printing is up sixfold, healthcare costs are rising, labor participation rates are falling, workers' share of the economy is falling, family income is falling, and home ownership is falling. If you add them all together, it spells falling consumer prices, slower GDP, and historically low interest rates. Well, let's take a deeper look inside this cycle. And let's begin with consumer debt. The good news here is it is moderated. We are now back to levels reached just before the financial crisis. On a good note, credit card debt has fallen, although it's now starting to rise, which is usually indicative of a latter stage of a business cycle. What replaced it, and if there's a bubble, it is an automobile debt. So if you look right there, Americans are racking up more auto debt because they're buying more bigger, inexpensive cars. And this is important as an investor. Roughly about 30% of all auto loans are subprime loans. The reason that's important to you as an investor, because they have been packaged and put into securities and sold to investors. And as you can see right now, we are now starting to see defaults. The second bubble is in student loans. As you can see there, they amount to about $1.2 trillion. It's up 170% in the last 10 years. And one of the reasons that you have seen fewer home buying and fewer household formations is because of student loans. The average millennial getting married today brings $34,000 to $35,000 of debt into that marriage. So a husband and wife bring $70,000 of debt to begin their marriage of student loans. Now that assumes they did not attend private school or out of state where the debt levels can be well over $100,000. 42 million Americans owe $1.4 trillion in debt. And as you can see the statistics here, the debt levels are rising faster than wages. And if you take a look at the amount of debt compared to wage, it's up threefold. And right now, 11.5% of all student loans are either in default or 90 days past due. So it's the next, what I call, bubble crisis. The next level of debt is corporate debt. And as you can see there, it has increased, and especially over the last couple of years. Now, why has corporate debt increased? Even though profits have gone up, there's several reasons. Corporations are playing interest rate arbitrage and tax arbitrage, and let me explain what I mean by this. In 2014, Apple, which was sitting on over $200 billion in cash, Microsoft, and Intel all issued debt. Now, why would you issue debt when you're sitting in a bank account that had more cash than you can spend? Let me explain why with one example. Intel issued a $5 billion bond at an interest rate of 1.6%. Intel's stock at that time was paying a dividend yield of 4.25%. So what did Intel do with that $5 billion? They bought back their stock. Now, what did that do? It did three things. Number one, if you reduce the number of shares that you own, what happens to your profits? Your profits go up. You're dividing your profits among fewer shares. So you saw an increase in Intel's earnings. Number two, they were playing arbitrage with interest rates. Intel was buying back stock, exchanging a rate of interest of 1.6% compared to the dividend they paid of 4.25%. So they were actually increasing their cash flow because they were cutting back on the number of shares and the dividends they paid at 4.25% and substituting an interest rate of 1.6. Number three, when Intel pays out a dividend, it does not get a tax deduction. When it borrows money and pays interest on that bond, guess what? It gets a tax deduction. So corporations were winning in three ways. Buying back their stock increased their earnings, retiring dividends that were higher than what they could borrow, increased their cash flow, and by issuing debt, it was deductible, they reduced the taxes they paid to the government. So it was one of the main reasons why we've seen this tremendous increase in corporate buybacks. And by the way, what makes this bull market different than those that preceded it, the majority of drivers of this bull market has not been individual investors. It's been corporations who have bought to the tune of $500 billion of stock every single year. There are fewer companies and shares outstanding today than there was 2 decades ago. The other buyers of stock have been central banks until recently. With the Trump presidency, the individual investor is back in the market for the first time in 9 years, which is what you want to see towards the end of a bull market. Everybody wants to get rich. There's nothing worse than finding out your neighbor is getting rich. And so people are coming back into the market. The final borrower of the debt supercycle is government. And you can see these percentages are based on GDP. And this is from the Congressional Budget Office and Treasury. You can see government spending will gradually increase. And we see longer term a devaluation of the dollar and a debt crisis somewhere in the next decade. This is where the revenues are. You can see they're declining. The deficit, which was actually positive in 2000, gradually you're seeing that deficit increase. Debt as a percentage of GDP is gradually growing. Now, what has happened with this is a result of what the Fed's done. It has brought interest rates down at all levels. There's your 10-year Treasury note. There is high-grade corporate bonds, and this is junk bonds. Another thing that we're starting to see, which is another clue to us that we're at the end of the business cycle. Junk bonds paid 9% 2 years ago. Today, they're 5.5%. If you take a look at junk bond issuance and investor inflows, they are more than double than where they were a year ago. So as yields have fallen, people are searching for yields. Money's coming back into the junk bond market. It's coming back into the junk bond emerging market, which is another sign that we look at to tell us that we're in a final stage of a market. You've got individual investors coming back into stocks. You've got individual investors coming back into junk bonds and lower quality credits. This is what you always see at the end of a business cycle. And the other thing that's very characteristic of a business cycle towards the end is euphoria. Business cycles don't end when things are bad. That's why in our earlier themes of recessions, we said there are more things that are right about the economy. Think of when we were in the last 2 recessions. The last recession began in December 2007. What were we feeling back in 2007? We were all going to get rich on housing. You just buy a house and you get rich. California definition of a millionaire is a homeowner. You take a look at the year 2000. What were people feeling in January of 2000? The new economy. We were all going to get rich by investing in the market, and the government and the central bank had repealed business cycles. The peak in business cycles, the peak in investment markets always occur at the end when everything looks rosy. They don't occur when things look bad. So we've got once more the signs of impending recession and bear market. The other thing that happened with central bank intervention in the markets is the relationship between stocks and bonds were broken. If you take a look at the Fed raising interest rates as they began in December of 2015, as they did in December of 2016, January of 2017, everybody was predicting interest rates were going to go up. What happened? They went in the opposite direction. Once again, foreign money coming into the U.S. compared to interest rates overseas. Another reason that we have also seen interest rates remain low, in every recession, the level of consumer prices came down. You've heard the Fed with its target of 2% inflation, it's been unable to meet that. Now, you can find inflation at different levels. If you look at the general level, it's under 2%. It's somewhere around 1.6 today. If you look in healthcare, it's probably running between 6 and 8% a year. If you're looking at education, it's running at 6 to 8. So it depends on what inflation, but if you look at inflation in the overall economy, it has been coming down. Now, I want to talk about a very powerful force that has changed inflation in the economy. It's called the disruptors. If you think of what these devices have done, the iPod changed the way we listen to music. It changed the way we buy music. I'll never forget, in, I think it was 2001, my son Adam had his first iPod. I was going to take my dogs out for a walk. I had the big Sony Walkman on my shoulder. And I looked at him and I go, what the heck is that? He goes, Dad, this is going to change music. You ought to buy Apple. It was at $14 a share. It's at an equivalent of $1,000. I should have listened to him. The other disruptor was the iPhone. It changed the telephone industry. It changed cell phones. Gone are the names you hear so much about, Nokia and Motorola, who thought phones were simply for calling people. The smartphone in 2007 changed that. It's hard to believe that I began my career out of graduate school, believe it or not, programming IBM mainframe computers. Now, my kids will tell you I'm a techno idiot when it comes to technology today. I just learned to text about a year and a half ago, so I don't want to date myself. The iPad disrupted the computer industry. And I want to take out a few props here. Just bear with me here, because I think they're very important to understand what's happening to the economy today. You stay with me during the break. I'll be doing magic tricks up here on the stage. These little devices may seem very simple. This is an iPod. It changed the music industry. It changed entertainment. It changed the dominance of consumer electronics from Sony to Apple. Very simple device. The next device are smartphones. It ushered in the digital age. They became computers. This little device is more powerful than the IBM computers I was programming in the 1970s. It's a camera. It's GPS. It's a phone. It's an email device. It's entertainment. The next device is the watch. I've got the Apple III Watch 2. It is now a phone. So I no longer need to take my phone with me. I can simply make phone calls on my watch. Now, bear with me on the next device, because it's probably the most powerful I'm going to show you in this seminar. And this one bears a little story. In the year 1453, the Sultan Mehmed II began a siege of Constantinople in 1453. Constantinople represented the eastern end of the Roman Empire that had been in existence for 1,000 years. When Attila the Hun invaded Rome and then began to invade Constantinople, he looked at its walls, which were 16 feet thick. They were double walls in a moat. And so it gave rise to castles and moats that were the protective means of cities. Well, Mehmet II did something that no other attacker did before. He amassed 69 cannons. They called him the Monster. It was 27 feet long, 7 inches thick, 30 inches across, and fired cannonballs weighing 200 to 1,500 pounds at a distance of a mile. He assembled those 70 cannons across out of archer's range and did what no other conqueror did before him. He conquered and ended the Roman Empire and conquered Constantinople. Now, I want you to bear with me. This device is called an Amazon Echo. Amazon is the Ottoman Turks. This device is the cannon. Now, let me explain its significance and relate it to what happened yesterday. What Amazon is doing is they're making buying and shopping effortless. With the Echo, you no longer have to click. It's just a voice. But let me tell you what this is doing. It's assaulting every single company that Warren Buffett likes to invest in. Warren Buffett likes to invest in companies that have an economic moat, a brand image. This is the destroyer of brand images. It's the destroyer of trillions of dollars that have been spent in advertising building brands. And let me tell you what happens. When you call Alexa, you say, Alexa, I need Q-tips. It doesn't ask you Do you want Johnson & Johnson? No, what Amazon is going to do is sell you something called Amazon Basics. It's Amazon's in-house brands, which are much cheaper. Yesterday, Procter & Gamble reported its earnings. They missed on their earnings front. They missed on their sales front. What the CEO did not want to tell every analyst in the room is brand loyalty was declining across all categories of its product. Amazon owns Gillette. Gillette has been supplanted by Shave Club, where you can get razors for $5 a month, or Harry's. Duracell batteries are now a generic brand. So what this is doing is destroying moats across all categories. Now let me talk about other moats. There are other companies out there, Facebook, Google, Airbnb. Quite honestly, Mary and I are not relying on our own Social Security. We're going to rent our upstairs bedrooms out to Airbnb when our son moves out. Let me tell you what's coming forward in the assault on different industries. There you have, as I said, this right here is a destroyer of economic moats that have been created by companies. I don't care if it's Heinz, Kraft, all brand images. And there was a survey of affluent investors in the area of fashion. Those that could identify a particular brand has fallen from 80 to 61%, in jewelry from 50 to 40, in hotels from 67 to 37, in retailers from 47 to 28. Now, let me explain very quickly here. The following industries are going to be assaulted. Why did Amazon buy Whole Foods? It's buying it because 50% of Amazon's costs are fulfillment. So with Whole Foods, they gain 450 stores or distribution centers. The one gorilla going up against Amazon and catching up quickly is Walmart. The grocery industry is under assault. The grocery store that you're going to see in the future is going to be much different than the one you shop at today. Amazon has already started this with Amazon Fresh and now Amazon Go. Amazon Go, you will take your little smartphone, walk into a grocery store. There will be no checker to greet you. There will be no stockers. There will be robots. And that program will record every device you put in your basket. And if you take it out, it'll record that as well. And you will walk out of the store. It'll be self-service. You're seeing this in grocery stores today. How many of you have been to a grocery store and seen the self-checkout machines? It's a beginning. At risk, 3,500 cashiers, 2.8 million salespeople, and 1.2 million stockers. If you've ever been to an Amazon warehouse, the one thing that you see is the absence of people. The apparel industry is also coming under assault. In the future, and Amazon is picking up on this, you will order your clothes. They will come in a box, and you will get a separate box that will be empty. You will simply try the clothes, put on the ones you like, and send back the ones you don't. The other thing that is coming is the transportation industry is going to come out for assault. Look out, FedEx, DHL, and UPS. Amazon is accumulating its own fleet of private jets, its tractor trailer rigs, soon drones and driverless Uber cars. Consumer brands, I mentioned, are coming out of assault. Communications is another area. Look what happened to the networks with cable TV, satellite TV. Look what happened to newspapers with the internet. Look what happened with advertising. The largest media companies in the world today no longer are the networks. They're no longer the newspapers. There are two companies, Facebook and Google. The market cap of these companies allow them cheap forms of capital. Four companies alone represent $2.5 trillion. Last year in advertising, Facebook and Google accounted for 43 to 60% of the increase in advertising revenues spent. Apple owns 14.5% of the smartphone market. They control nearly 80% of its profits. If you look at Amazon, it dominates the entire ecosystem in retail. 55% of all inquiries into products take place on Amazon. Where are we heading? Let's talk about the end game. I talked about interest rates are at an extraordinary period of time in history. We are in the final phase of the bull market. The result has been lower economic growth, lower inflation, and interest rates. Let's talk about how this ends. This graph will be more important in the next decade than it is, but I want to show it to you anyway. It's a picture of CPI. During the Great Depression, prior to Roosevelt's entry into the presidency, deflation was 10 to 12% a year. Prices were falling at a rate we had never seen before. Within his first month of office, Roosevelt devalued the dollar from $20 for an ounce of gold to $35. He devalued the currency by 60% in a single month, ended deflation. We were back on the inflation trail. So never believe anybody telling you the government can't create inflation. They can. And it's done ultimately through devaluation. Here's the graph I showed you at the beginning. The only thing I want to point out here, this is where we are now. And we know every time they begin a cycle, this is what it ends up in. So how do we know where we are? We believe we're in the final phase of a bull market. When you're in a recession, economic growth is declining, inflation is coming down, bonds do well because the Fed is lowering interest rates. As a result of lower interest rates, the Fed stimulates the economy, stocks do well. Eventually, you get to the final phase of the bull market as inflation starts to increase, commodities do well, and then as we get into a downturn, we get back to bonds and cash. So if you look at the cycles of the economy, when you come out of a recession, the Fed's stimulating interest rates, growth is in decline, inflation is in decline, bonds do well. In the recovery phase, growth is picking up, we're still in a deflationary phase, stocks do well. In the final phase, when everything is firing on all cylinders, growth picks up, inflation picks up, commodities tend to do well, and then you get back to cash and bonds. What we're watching right now is the commodity markets, and you can see this is a 12-month graph of copper. Everybody calls it Dr. Copper. Here's oil prices, and here's the price of gold. So we have commodities, main ones, and especially base metals firing on all cylinders. How does this play out in the marketplace? There's a threefold sequence that plays out in the market. The first market to peak is interest rates. Why? The Fed is raising interest rates. As the Fed raises interest rates, the economy begins to slow down. The next market to peak is the stock market itself. And then finally, it's the commodity index because the economy's heating up. It's firing, and what happens? You're consuming more raw materials, bidding up the price. I saw a piece on the news last night. As a result of the hurricanes, there's a shortage of workers and materials, which is going to drive construction materials up and also wages because there's a shortage of workers. The same sequence played out in the year 2007. There's the bond market peaking. There's the stock market. This was an unusual extension of the commodity cycle, which did not peak until a year later. And that was mainly the price of oil going from about $75 a barrel to $150 a barrel. So where are we? Number one, we believe we're in an extraordinary era. Never before in mankind have you seen interest rates go in a 40-year period from the peak or where they were 5,000 years ago to the lowest point in history today, where nearly $9 trillion of government bonds are at a negative interest rate. In other words, you pay the government to loan them money. We are also at the end of a debt supercycle with the biggest debtor, the U.S. government. The budget deficit this year will be somewhere in the neighborhood of about $650 to $700 billion. We're back on the way to trillion-dollar deficits. We are now entering the third phase of a business cycle. We've been given the two-minute warning, and the market is in a topping process. And we'll be going over, and Chris will, in the second hour, about market valuations, where they are today, the business cycle, and the process of de-risking. I want to leave you with this as we close. That is the 10-year note. And the Federal Reserve plays something that we call the confidence game. I don't know why they're always wrong on 95% of their forecasts, but we still believe them. But they do that for a reason, because as long as people have confidence in authorities and the Federal Reserve, they can maintain the stability of interest rates. And even though we devalued the dollar in 1971, the Fed was able to keep interest rates within a 2% range until people lost confidence in the Fed. And you can see there, we went from that 7 or 8% range all the way up to almost 16% in a period of 3 years. So that's why they like to maintain that mystique and that prestige, because as long as people have confidence in the system, they have confidence in the Fed, the currency. So in summary, we're at the end of the debt supercycle. We've been given a 2-minute warning, borrowing from football, and we are now in the process of a topping, which Chris Paplava will cover in the next hour. Thank you.
You've been listening to a special holiday program of the Financial Sense Insider, featuring highlights from Jim Paplava's Investment Strategy Conference from October 21st of this year. Tomorrow, on our normal weekend Financial Sense News Hour, we'll present more highlights from the conference, so make sure and join us then.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense News Hour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSM. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Paplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.